I think one of the talks that got my attention was a discussion on neuroethics. What's your personal thoughts in this space?
So it's definitely something that is coming up a lot at the moment. People talking about we have to be careful,
Yes.
especially that one big component of a lot of these BCIs is the what we call the AI part or machine learning.
Yep.
Because you have to imagine that you have multiple electrodes and sometimes hundreds of electrodes recording continuous signals, and that's a lot of data. And it's not easy to understand how what does this data mean. And so this is where AI and machine learning is extremely helpful to help us interpret this information and to extract actual information about what's happening in the brain. So this is obviously great, and it has a lot of potential to help people. But on the other end, people are being more and more afraid of, what do you do with this data?
Yes, who controls it? Who owns it? Yeah.
Exactly. So I think in general, people agree that there's huge potential to really help people, and that should not stop us. We should really, focus on that. But we need to keep in mind that there are probably some people, or there's a risk that, some people use these technologies
Yes,
for
yes.
a bad way. And so the whole question is,
Nefarious reasons, yes.
and so how do you
How do you
mitigate
control
this?
that? How do you manage that? Which
Exactly.
actually kindly gets me nicely onto, I think it's continuing somewhat with this line of conversation in terms of control. It's about regulations. I mean, how does the company navigate the regulatory landscape, especially considering the very unique challenges of bioelectronics?
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Heads Talk with me, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter, the podcast where we talk to C-level executives, leaders of institutions, and heads of multinationals. What are the current topics they talk? We listen.
Can you imagine getting into a business or a market where you actually spend 100 billion plus on a piece of paper?
Are you kidding me?
It was like a frying pan to the head.
I got nothing against CFOs.
It was not just the job of a lifetime, it was the job of a thousand lifetimes.
My guest today is one of the youngest we have had on the show. The successful launch of his organization and the work they are doing has brought him to the attention of Heads Talk. We're going to talk about BCI today and how his organization is making a mark in this area. But before we get into that, here's a brief message.
Heads Talk podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.
Nicholas Vachikouras is the CEO of Neurosoft Bioelectronics, a company he co-founded in 2019. In addition to raising approximately $9 million in funding, he was actively involved in establishing a medical-grade manufacturing line for the production of neural implants and starting first-in-human studies in the US in 2023. Academically, Nicholas graduated with a MSc in microengineering from EPFL, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, Lausanne, in 2014, and then completed a PhD in microelectronics again at EPFL, where he focused on developing soft neural interfaces at the laboratory of Professor Lacour. During his PhD, Nicholas also worked as a research and development consultant for Lever Neurotherapeutics, a neuromodulation startup. Let's begin. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Nicholas to Heads Talk. Many thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Excellent. Okay, the natural first question is to ask what inspired the foundation of Neurosoft Bioelectronics, and what is the overarching mission of the company?
That's a good question. So originally, it started when I finished my bachelor's degree at EPFL, and I met Professor Lacour, where I joined her lab. And she was working on this concept of soft bioelectronics, so meaning devices that are interfacing with the nervous system, the brain or spinal cord, but using what we call soft materials. And so that's really what got me into the field of what we call neurotechnology. And that's really like how I got started into this. And very quickly, I decided that I really wanted to create a company to bring these technologies from the bench and lab to the clinic of patients. And so that was really how I got started into the field and how we started Neurosoft Bioelectronics a few years later. And our goal overall with these devices is really to help people who suffer from severe neurological disorders and that require these type of devices.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for that, Soma. We're going to talk into greater detail about what you mean by soft. So, but for now, you know, it's hard to believe so much has happened between 2019 and now 2023. So let me ask, how has the company's vision evolved since its inception?
Yeah, I mean, at the very beginning, we started with what we call a platform technology. So we had these very nice electrodes that are made of these softer elastic materials. But, you know, we can do a lot of things with them. So I usually take as an example or a comparator, like the heart, you can read the heart like an EKG, or the pacemaker, you can send electrical pulses. So the brain and the spinal cord is the same thing, where you can read or write. So meaning you can record the activity or send electrical pulses. And as you can imagine, the brain controls everything in the body.
Yes.
And so there is a lot of different things you can do with such technologies. At the end of the day, you can provide sight to people who are blind, provide hearing sensations to people who are deaf. You can, you know, remove tremor from patients with Parkinson's. There's so many different things. So for us, we started with a technology, but what had to be evolved is, okay, what are we going to focus on in terms of clinical indication? What is really the, you know, disorders or diseases that we really want to help patients leveraging our technology? And so that's what evolved a lot over the last few years in terms of the mission and the vision.
Okay. Can you give us a sense of the look and feel of your product and exactly where it is used? You talked about the spinal cord, you talked about the heart, you talked about the brain. Where is it used and to what end?
So imagine a like elastic material that like you have a rubber band. It's the same type of feeling. And they are quite thin, so below 1 millimeter. And so they are like a sheet that can be positioned on the surface of nervous tissue. So you really have to imagine that we're below the skull, so really at the surface of the brain. And these devices, we call them interfaces, they contain electrodes. So like small circular electrical contacts that can record or stimulate. So that's really the general concept of what it looks like. And as I mentioned before, these devices can read or write, meaning they can record or stimulate. So that's really what the technology is.
That's excellent. And obviously, prior to our conversation, I did my own research and I read some of your stuff or stuff written about you and your work that you're doing, but I want you to explain this for my listeners, because I looked at your product, I looked at what you're doing, because assuming your product is also used for what you'd call drug-resistant epilepsy patients. So how exactly does this work on them?
Exactly. So obviously, depending on the indication, the mechanism will be different. So in the particular case of epilepsy, which is one of the two key indications we're targeting, so for these patients, you have to imagine that these are patients who have seizures. And typically, you know, these seizures can be highly debilitating or life-threatening. And the first course of action for these patients is to take drugs. And drugs work in a lot of cases, but only about 60 to 70% of patients really respond to drugs. So the remaining 30, 40% are what we call drug resistant. And so for these patients, one of the potential best course of actions is to actually remove the part of the brain that causes a seizure. And so in the context of the surgery, there is two challenges. The first one is to identify and localize where the seizures come from. And often it's not very easy to actually, it's not easy to find where this they come from. So this is where the electrodes come in play, and you can position them on the surface of the brain. And you can basically monitor the patient for a few weeks. And during this period of time, you hope to have one or two seizures. And during the seizure with the recordings, you can identify where the seizure comes from. So that's really a tool to help the surgeon identify where the seizure comes from. And then the electrode can also be used during the surgery itself to make sure that, well, you removed everything, but also to make sure you don't damage other parts of the brain that are critical. So just to give you an example, if the part of the seizure is close to the motor cortex, which is the part of the brain that, for example, allows you to move your hands, you want to make sure you don't damage the neurons that allow you to move your hands. And so the electrodes in this context can really allow you to map the brain during surgery to make sure that you know what is what, you know where is the part of the brain you have to remove, where is the part of the brain that you want to keep functional, and to help the surgeon guide the resection. So that's really how these devices can help patients by really providing better tools for the surgeon.
Okay, so I understand how it works sort of intellectually. Can you provide my listeners with a real world application, a case study, obviously without naming names, on where the product has really made a difference?
So we just started our clinical studies for now, but for example, we had one patient that had epileptic seizures, as I described, and mm-hmm. they had to remove the parts of the brain that cause a seizure. And so during the surgery, we used the electrodes to identify different brain regions. Mm-hmm. And the whole goal was just to make sure that we don't damage more than what's necessary, and that we also are sure that we've removed all the pathological parts of the brain to make sure that the patients could really be seizure free. Because what you really want to avoid is doing a surgery, you close everything up, but actually afterwards you realize that the parts of the brain that cause a seizure are still present, mm-hmm. and you have to redo a second surgery. So that's mm-hmm. an example how a device like this would be used and how it can impact the patients.
This is so delicate, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, let's talk about BCIs in general. Yes. It's come a long way since its inception. What has changed in recent times with its acceptance and efficacy?
So I think there's, well, two things. In general, in terms of the mainstream media, there's a lot more, you know, people knowing about BCIs. And I think this was really fueled by Elon Musk's company Neuralink, who, you know, typically people follow a lot what he does. And the day he started working on this field, I think it brought the attention to the mainstream people, media, and also investors into this field. So I think that's something that really changed the landscape, is having mm-hmm. high profile people start talking about it and really mentioning it. I think that's something that really had a huge impact for us, because now more people know about these thanks to mm-hmm. Elon Musk and others like him. So I think mm-hmm. that's one thing. Obviously, we're still early on in terms of where we're at with these technologies, so it's hard to really talk about acceptance. But I feel like people are, you know, we see people are more and more, I would say, eager to say, you know, why don't I get an implant in my brain, for example, if it can mm-hmm. really help me. Mm-hmm. I still think it's early to really talk about how this has impacted acceptance, but I think already knowing about it slowly and talking about it in the media, I think people will get used to it. The same way today, when you have to take a pill, you don't ask any questions, even though you can ask.
It's like heart surgery. At one point, that was a sort of an impossibility, and now it's kind of a norm, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the efficacy, that is getting better and better, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I mean, these trials are there's not that many patients, at least if we talk about real BCIs. Now, we have to keep in mind that, you know, BCIs is a very technical term. But if you look at it from a more, you know, general perspective, and I really like to talk about what we call neural interfaces, so basically a device that interfaces with the brain mm-hmm. or spinal cord, these devices have existed for many, many years. The most three best examples to give you that probably people are aware of, first are cochlear implants. So these are devices mm-hmm. that go into the ear. They're mm-hmm. also made of electrodes. They also send electrical pulses, but they're not directly on the brain. They just stimulate the cochlea, which is the termination of the auditory nerve that goes into the brain. So mm-hmm. I think that's an example of a very successful device, because people, you know, I know a lot of people who would typically be deaf, and mm-hmm. thanks to these devices can hear. So I think this obviously has been better and better as we were able to be more precise when we stimulate, how we stimulate. Mm-hmm. The other big market for these are what we call deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's. So here you have to really imagine a device that enters the brain. So it's really a brain interface, and it stimulates a particular brain in patients with Parkinson's. And it's quite impressive to look at videos of this being active. You can imagine a patient shaking. And as mm-hmm. soon as you activate this electrode and you start stimulating the right location, the shaking will go away. And now there's been progress trying to make this better, to improve the efficacy of these devices. But this is another example of a successful, you know, device on the market. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Excellent, excellent. That's good stuff. You attended the recent Brain Mind Summit in San Francisco. Tell my listeners about your takeaways from the event.
Yeah, so it was a very interesting event. I mean, it was a big mix of, let's say, some companies, but also researchers in the field of brain technologies or mm-hmm. more behind. There was a lot of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. So for me, at least, if I was mostly interested in the, let's say, neurotechnology aspects of it. Mm-hmm. And so we had the chance to see some talks about people who really are using BCIs to impact real people. Mm-hmm. I think two of the most prominent, you know, figures in the space at the moment on one end is the company called Synchron. So they are using BCI, but they have a very unique approach where they go through the blood vessels to record the activity of the brain. And so it was very impressive to see the ability in multiple patients now to basically control a smartphone, if you may, or an interface just by thinking. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of work has also been done at UCSF in San Francisco by Eddie Chang, who is a neurosurgeon and who has done recently a lot of very nice work in what we call speech prosthesis, or a BCI for speech. So imagine patients who are completely unable to speak or to communicate because they had a stroke or spinal cord injury, mm-hmm. or they're completely what we call locked in, but the brain is still functioning. And mm-hmm. so he showed how you can, you know, record the intention of speech of these patients and mm-hmm. have a computer interpret this information and then have an output on the screen of what the patient is trying to say. And so I think that was really nice to see, you know, what has been done on that end. Mm-hmm. So I would say a lot of it was on this technical aspect. I really enjoyed it, and just to, you know, also meet the people who work on these things.
Incredible work's happening there. Was it a 2-day or a week event?
Yeah, it was a 2-day event over the weekend. And so it was a mix of, you know, as I said, different talks, but
I think one of the talks that got my attention was a discussion on neuroethics. What's your personal thoughts in this space?
So it's definitely something that is coming up a lot at the moment, people talking about we have to be careful, especially that one big component of a lot of these BCIs is the what we call the AI part or machine learning. Yep. Because, you know, you have to imagine that you have multiple electrodes and sometimes hundreds of electrodes recording continuous signals, and that's a lot of data. And it's, you know, it's not easy to you know, understand how, what does this data mean. And so this is where AI and machine learning is extremely helpful to help us interpret this information and to extract actual information about what's happening in the brain. Mm-hmm. So this is obviously great, and it has a lot of potential to help people. But on the other end, people are being more and more afraid of, you know, what do you do with this data? You know,
yes, who controls it? Who owns it? Yeah.
Exactly. So I think in general, people agree that there's huge potential to really help people, and that should not stop us. We should really, you know, focus on that. But we need to keep in mind that there are probably some people, or there's a risk that, you know, some people use these technologies for a bad way. And so the whole question.
Nefarious reasons, yes.
Yeah. And so how do you.
How do you control that? How do you manage that? Which actually kindly gets me nicely onto, I think it's continuing somewhat with this line of conversation in terms of control. It's about regulations. I mean, how does the company navigate the regulatory landscape, especially considering the very unique challenges of bioelectronics?
No, it's a very good question. So I would say there's a big part of it that is common to all medical devices. So obviously, at least for the US, we are in constant discussion with the FDA. Mm-hmm. So that's a very nice thing, at least in the US, you can really have a nice channel with the main regulatory body, which is the FDA, mm-hmm. to discuss with them and to understand what are their expectations. What do they want? What do they want to see? Mm-hmm. And you can really talk early on. So that's something that we've been doing from the beginning to make sure that what we do is aligned with their expectations. And I think that's something that is very powerful in the US. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of medical device companies are going there because there's this, let's say, more clarity in terms of the regulatory expectations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, when you run trials or when you're having a device, there's always about consent. You know, you want to make sure that, you know, you ask patients' consent. That's what we also did in our first trial in the US. Every single patient is asked, okay, do you agree for us to start our device and you? So I think these are, you know, well-established standards, well-established rules that, you know, I believe most companies follow. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously what we're also doing on our end.
Okay. Moving on to something we like to talk about on Heads Talk, that's collaborations and partnerships.
Yeah.
Who, if at all, are you collaborating with to further Neurosoft Bioelectronics growth and success. I hear you talk about working in the US. So who are you collaborating with?
So obviously we have a lot of different types of collaborators. To focus on the US, for example, our main type of collaboration is what we call clinical, meaning with doctors.
Yep.
And so I would say the most important one today is the surgeon, Professor Nitin Tendon, who is in Houston in Texas, and who was the first to test our devices in patients. Mm-hmm. And so for us, it's a very important collaboration because obviously, you know, he helped us, you know, get into the first trials, but also he provides great input in terms of the device, like what works, what doesn't, what should we change, how we should improve it to make it more usable, more user-friendly. So that's an example of a very strong collaboration. Obviously, he's not the only one. We have two strong collaborations in Europe, one in Geneva and one in Utrecht in Netherlands. So for us doctors, to answer foreign part of the question, is really clinicians to make sure we're developing something that, you know, properly done. Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of different stakeholders that you're collaborating with, and naturally, of course, you're going to be doing that. One of the questions that I asked, I think in my last series of the Neurotech series on Heads Talk, when I spoke to so many leaders like yourself, and one of the things that we talked about was about commercializing the product. Has that changed over the year now? Is it a little bit easier from, you know, clinical trials to actually commercializing it, or is there a real big gap between the two?
Yes. I mean, it's so we're not there yet. We're discovering. But what I can tell you, at least in Europe, it's more difficult.
regulations?
So there was a huge change in the what we call medical device regulations in Europe.
All right.
It's really impacting startup companies because it makes it harder for new technologies to bring to the market. And that's actually why we're mostly focused in the US for now. Mm-hmm. So I think, at least for Europe, there's a clear change in the past few years. And I think if you talk to any company developing new products, 90% of them will probably start in the US.
Right.
So I think here, I would say more difficult. But on the other hand, I would say on the US side, the FDA has, at least, I don't know if it's changed in the past because it's the first time we're doing it, but at least we're very satisfied of the level of them helping us design our clinical studies and make sure that we can go through this, you know, as smoothly, as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And they're really, I was really impressed, to be honest, on the level of, you know, how much they read about what we sent them. Really, like, the even at the point that they were proactive, like they said, please send us your protocol for this test. You know, we want to make sure that whatever you're going to do is exactly what we expect. So I really like that. And it's a big contrast with Europe.
It's the new and exciting tech, isn't it? Neurotech, because everybody wants to know, I think, because it's kind of shiny and new. So I'm a bit surprised when you say in Europe they're a little bit more stringent in terms of the development of that. So we will see, I suppose, over the years if that will loosen and allow further innovations to pick up. Sorry, you were saying?
No. So it's a good point. So the problem, at least in Europe, is that, you know, there's no special rules for neurotech. You know, it's we fall under the medical devices, and it's the same rules for everyone. The nice thing with the US, and I think that's helping a lot of people, is that they generate guidelines, and they actually recently came out with guidelines for BCIs, and so that's also super helpful to have, you know, official documents that you can have a good starting point. Specific to neurotech. So that's also another big difference to keep in mind. Yeah.
That's good. That's excellent. At least this allows progress for some of the stuff you're doing. I can imagine the frustration if you're still working and depending on sort of Europe in order to do these things.
Yeah.
Okay. With these final sort of questions, let's look at the future and industrial trends. First, what are the plans for Neurosoft Bioelectronics in the next 2 to 5 years?
So our goal within the next year or so is to bring our first product to market, the one we just described before for epilepsy. Yep. So we plan on submitting to the FDA next year. So that's kind of the next big milestone for us. And the other one that we're very excited about is a very specific indication that we really want to treat with our device, which is severe tinnitus. So it's, you know, you probably have experienced it, is this ringing in the ear, buzzing sound that you can have after a loud concert. And so we believe that we can develop an approach using brain-computer interfaces to stimulate specific brain regions in some of these patients to completely suppress or at the very least reduce dramatically the sound, this buzzing sound perceived. Mm-hmm. And so for us, in the next 2 to 5 years, we really want to bring this to the clinic, to start clinical studies, demonstrate that it's possible, and then obviously commercialize it. So that's really our main focus in terms of indications.
Do you want to commercialize this under the Neurosoft and Bioelectronics banner?
Yes. So for now, that's the goal. I think, obviously, at one point, you know, as the project gets de-risked and matures, we think it would make sense to partner with bigger companies, mm-hmm. Especially for the commercialization. It's another thing, you know, like our expertise is really on the technology, on the regulatory, clinical quality side of things. Mm-hmm. And already that is difficult. But then you enter in a different realm when you start selling. Yeah. And so I think,
yeah, obviously, to share the risk, so to speak.
Yeah, so I think it makes sense strategically to leverage companies that are on this space, that have experience, that already have the distribution networks. Mm-hmm. And so we will see if it's going to be under the Neurosoft banner, as you say. It might be, or it might be under someone else's name in the future. But mm-hmm. I think it would be a mistake to at least not try to work with these people, because we could save a lot of money and time collaborating with the right partners.
Yeah. Yeah. I spoke in the last series on the new tech series. I spoke with the chief technology officer, the group chief technology officer of Starkey Hearing. I don't know if you've heard of Starkey Hearing, and you know that's a potential organization or parallel to organizations that you could potentially partner with in terms of developing that side of the business. And in terms of industry trends, what next for BCI is that excites you, that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, well, different aspects. I think one part that is really exciting is really combining with AI and machine learning. I think we've seen how powerful it is, you know, like everyone talks about ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. And I think particularly a very good example is in the context of speech BCIs. So these devices that can read brain signals and transform them into words. Mm-hmm. These types of models, I think combining these could really improve how much the patients can speak, let's say, through their brain. Mm-hmm. And I think that's extremely exciting to really combine the power of AI. But mm-hmm. for us, you know, our rationale with our company is that in order to have, you know, these kind of AI working, you need data. And to have data, you need good devices. And mm-hmm. I think that's where there's a, you know, a big gap, or at least it's closing slowly with all companies. But we really want to make sure that we have devices that are reliable, that are safe, and that can record, you know, good quality signals and data, so that we can then, you know, use it to train new models and make better devices. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm quite excited about, you know, the moment where we will be, you know, implanted long-term with our devices, generating a lot of data, and then leveraging all this to really, you know, take advantage of these new AI models, mm-hmm. to really unlock huge potential for this technology. So I think that's one of the most exciting parts of what we're doing at the moment.
That's excellent. I wonder what advice you would give to professionals sort of aspiring to make significant impact in the field of bioelectronics or neurotechnology.
So, I mean, there's so many things we've learned along the way. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to keep in mind that even though there's a big, you know, data component to what we do in AI, we have to keep in mind these are medical devices. These are medical devices. And as you may know, medical devices are classified depending on risk. There's class 1, 2, and 3 in the US. Class 3 is the highest risk. And so when we talk about implantable BCIs, it's a class 3 medical device. And that has huge regulatory implications that some people are not necessarily aware of. And mm-hmm. I think, at least if you're going for an invasive device, it's really important to really take these things into consideration from very, very early on. You know, you have quality affairs to manage, clinical, regulatory, mm-hmm. and you really need people who can help you navigate the space. It's extremely complex. It's really evolving all the time, and that's extremely hard to keep up. Mm-hmm. And so I think, obviously, you know, you need your tech team. Obviously, you need, you know, people who know how to write code. You need people who know how to build devices. But you also especially need to really take into account the fact that you're building a medical device, which is a highly regulated, you know, environment. And you probably need also expertise in this and to take this into account very early on. I think that's something that is very important.
Okay. Nicholas Varikouras, a very informative conversation today on Heads Talk. I wish you well with your organization. So many thanks for your time and insights.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for joining me today on this episode of Heads Talk. Don't forget to subscribe to the show via my website, elainepringle.com/headstalk, or wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, I'd like to thank our sponsors, guests, and you for helping to make the show possible. Please join me next time where I'll be featuring more executives, C-suite leaders, and heads of multinationals.
Heads Talk podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.